right, and our final presenter today is April Shelford, who completed her PhD in history at Princeton University in 1997. She published Transforming the Republic of Letters, Pierre Daniel Huet and the European Intellectual Life, 1650 to 1720, in 2007. A two-year visiting professorship at the University of the West Indies, Jamaica, inspired her current project, A Caribbean Enlightenment. Her research so far has resulted in articles published in Studies in 18th Century Culture, Atlantic Studies, and History of European Ideas. She contributed a chapter of Mudfish, Harpsichords, and Books, love the title, Libraries and Community in 18th Century Jamaica, to Before Public Libraries, Reading, Community, and Identity in the Atlantic World, 1650 to 1850, just published by Brill. And she is presenting today The Enlightened Planter.
Well, first of all, I want to thank the organizers of this panel, and it's really delightful to be here with folks that I've served on panels before, and a newcomer, and this is great material, so I want to thank that, and also the organizers who gave me such a beautiful view when I opened up my window shades this morning. The Enlightened Planter, we're moving just to the Caribbean, and we're moving towards the productive aspect in terms of how planters actually got the enslaved labor to do what they were supposed to do, which was create profits for themselves and for France. In January 1777, the Observatoire Américain, a newspaper published on Dominica, printed a letter from nearby Guadeloupe. It responded to the news of a slave conspiracy in Jamaica. The anonymous correspondent mused why slave uprisings, quote, threatened the English colonies much more frequently than our own. Was it possible that the spirit of liberty that reigns there makes individuals much less suitable for managing slaves? Might the free man, then, be a harsher master than he who subjects himself to an absolute government? The proud republican, unrestrained by his laws, can he only be a fierce despot, close quote. He invited his compatriots, quote, to congratulate ourselves on knowing how to lighten the weight of the chains that an unhappy necessity forces us to impose. Let us congratulate ourselves that we do not excite in the heart of our slaves that dark and dangerous despair that makes them contemplate so often such catastrophes as in the English lands, close quote. The continuation of this letter shows that the Guadeloupe planter was not as complacent about the kind-heartedness of his fellow slaveholders as my quotation suggests. Nevertheless, his letter reflects how, in the French imagination, slave revolt was often identified with the English Caribbean. For example, in 1769, the poet Saint-Lambert published his celebrated poem cycle, The Seasons, with Zemeo. Zemeo was a tale of slave rebellion in Jamaica. It was written from the perspective of a merchant visiting the plantation of a Jamaican friend. The poem deplored English brutality, quote, I saw the planter surrounded by slaves whom they treated barbarously. I trembled at the excess of cruelty that greed can inspire in men, close quote. The situation on the estate of his enlightened friend Paul Wilmoth made for a dramatic contrast. Their slaves were, quote, arrayed in small families, where peace and gaiety reigned. These families were tight-knit. Each evening returning home, I heard their songs, their musical instruments, I saw their dances. Rarely was there illness amongst these slaves, little sloth, no thievery, no suicide, no conspiracy, and none of those crimes which despair inspires and sometimes wreck our colonies. And I should note, too, that this was not just a poetic intervention, though it was written in prose, but it received some wider distribution when Dupont de Nemours reviewed the book for the Éphéméride du Citoyen, and he included a very generous excerpt from Zemeo. Saint-Lambert's depiction of Wilmoth, whose sage management transformed his slave subjection into lives of hope and dignity, registered the increase in anti-slavery sentiment in France. This new fact of life made it difficult for Caribbean agricultural writers to assume the stance of earlier writers when discussing their enslaved laborers, that is, as a problem in labor management. Planters and colonial administrators alike grappled with the question posed by our contemporary scholar Jean Tirard, could slavery be reformed? In the remainder of this paper, I will show how two treatises on Caribbean agriculture answered yes. In the process, they elaborated a social ideal and identity, the enlightened planter. That's my terminology. As such, they attest to the existence of a meliorous line of thought in the French Caribbean, similar to ideas generated in the British Caribbean and North American slaveholding colonies. On the British side, this phenomenon has been drawing an increasing amount of scholarly attention. Though none is as astute as Joyce E. Chaplin's pioneering book, An Anxious Pursuit, Agricultural Innovation and Modernity in the Lower South, 1730-1815. It's a terrific book. Yet this discourse, if you will, of the enlightened planter has been largely neglected in French studies, as has the Caribbean literature of agricultural improvements that usually framed it, though it's drawing more attention now. Julia, yes, thank you. Here I discuss enlightened plantership through Jean-Samuel Guisson's treatise on the marshlands of French Guiana, published in Cayenne in 1788, and Jean-Baptiste Poyen de Sainte-Marie's Advice of an Old Planter to Young Agriculturalists of the Colonies, published in Guadeloupe in 1792. I could give you the titles in French, but it would be embarrassing for all concerned. Before I begin, let me stress, I have no idea whether these treatises inspired any slaveholder to implement any of the ideas they contained on his or her own estate. There is manuscript evidence of a rationalization of plantation management, but whether any planters bought into the necessary combination of humanity and interest that these authors asserted is much more difficult to ascertain. I want to stress, too, neither Guisson nor Poyen de Sainte-Marie was naive. Their works acknowledged, indeed to some degree, were motivated by the brutality of the slave regime they knew very well from living in the Caribbean for a very long time. Guisson was a Swiss engineer who arrived in French Guiana in 1778 after spending a few years in Dutch Suriname. He spent most of the 1780s engaged in the construction of an agricultural settlement in the swampy Guyanese lowlands that was meant to be a model for the colony's agriculturalists. Poyen de Sainte-Marie was a successful sugar planter on the island of Guadeloupe. We must recognize, too, that their manuals were acts of self-presentation. There is some corroboration in the historical record that Guisson practiced what he preached, but we know nothing about how Poyen de Sainte-Marie treated his slaves beyond his own claims. Finally, their manuals were informed by very different agricultural histories. Guisson struggled to establish profitable agricultural establishments in the virgin marshlands of an undeveloped struggling colony. In contrast, the plantation complex on Guadeloupe was mature, thus posed very different agricultural challenges. But while they differed in background and their manuals in details, their approaches were very similar. Guisson's phrase, habit enlightened by reflection, captures it perfectly. For both, the goal of estate management was achieving maximum prosperity within the limits of available resources. As such, it was a rational exercise, conducive to analysis and quantification. Thus, no planter could be a slave to precedent. Suriname might have appeared to offer precepts applicable to French Guiana, Guisson wrote, but the Dutch agriculturalists, however enlightened, sometimes thoughtlessly adhered to routines. The planter had to be alert to technological fixes, either inventing or adopting labor-saving devices. Guisson essentially invented a cotton gin. Poyen urged the adoption of the plow, and he imported German pumps so he wouldn't lose his sugar works to fire a third time. Work regimes had to be rationalized. Poyen detailed the coordinated movements of squads of slaves as they planted and fertilized a field. Guisson broke down planting into even finer units. Quote, at each stroke, the slaves raise their hoes. At the same time, they strike all together as if performing a drill. Such uniformity encourages them and obliges the lazy to follow the others. And he goes on at great length about this. And both men were constantly calculating. Guisson devoted an entire chapter to advice on determining how much time specific tasks required, thus how much labor each would take. Poyen included a chart as a model for how the planter should keep track of his production. Finally, both men nearly always took the long view. They frequently argued that more planning, more time, and more expense up front paid off in the future. Obviously, Guisson and Poyen's enlightened planter possessed considerable intelligence and energy. In Poyen's account, he was humane yet firm, industrious and judicious, quote, capable of managing all types of workers, ordering their agricultural tasks with as much foresight as sagacity, close quote. He could direct the sugar works and distillery. He knew enough mathematics to level a site or dig a canal. He could even assist the plantation doctor. He reconciled what his manufacturing operation needed with his means to achieve the best quality product at the best price. By virtue of his energy, his economy, his scrupulous adherence to every contractual obligation, he deserved the confidence of his fellow citizens and of metropolitan merchants, kind of an offhanded acknowledgement of just how bad this relationship frequently was between planters and merchants. For Guisson, There was no avoiding the fact that colonial architecture, quote, the major crops above all, demands a great effort, much courage, and unwavering constancy and perseverance, finally a certain ability and active persistence that will surmount and vanquish all difficulties, close quote. No less important, the planter possessed humanité and sensibilité, the elements of effective engagement that have necessarily accompanied calculation. In this, they showed the influence of a conception of human psychology that rooted human development in the capacity to be sensible, to receive impressions of the world beyond one's skin. With its origins in Locke, the sensationalist epistemology generated the possibility of a secular morality prompted by sentiment and an ideal of masculinity that transcended the intellectual acknowledgement of another's suffering to experiencing feelings that resonated with the unfortunates. Please note, neither Poyen nor Guisson had overly sentimental views of their slaves. They did not see them as Rousseau's happy and virtuous peasants laboring in the vineyard, nor did they either regard his slaves as his equal. Guisson was not as convinced of the naturalness of hierarchy as Poyen was, and Poyen expressed somewhat more negative views of his slaves' capacities. In fact, his knowledge, and I put that in quotes, of his slaves' characters, customs, and passions were largely long-standing stereotypes. Less inclined to essentialize, Guisson was more willing to ascribe slave vices to the example of their masters and to the demoralizing effects of slavery itself. But neither author ever suggested that their slaves were anything less, or more for that matter, than human beings. And they both derived at the relatively benign, if still deeply demeaning, view that they were children, sometimes malicious, according to Guisson, and most often heedless. But slaves were not stupid, and Poyen and Guisson agreed that they were quite capable of knowing and acting on their own interests. Quote, property is the lodestone that fixes men in their homes, Poyen wrote, whence one can conclude that every slave who has his home, his garden, all those things that are necessary for him to live with ease in his estate, and who moreover will be treated well by his master, will have great difficulty deciding to leave his home to run away to the woods, close quote. The good master took care to take care of the elderly, asserted Guisson, always addressing them with, quote, a decency that announces his satisfaction, generosity, and compassionate sensibility, close quote. Flattered by the master's consideration, they would be persuaded that, quote, their interests and those of their children are tightly and inseparably joined to those of the master and their prosperity, quote, close quote. The younger slaves would respect them all the more, and their spirits would be relieved of that natural anxiety they have for their children. Guisson agreed with Poyen that slaves were entitled to housing that permitted some measure of privacy, as well as a degree of personal autonomy in matters that did not concern the master or the maintenance of good order. Punishment was necessary to maintain good order and respect for authority, of course. But Guisson and Poyen also believed that their slaves had an acute sensitivity to injustice. Consequently, they spent pages defining precisely when, how, for what, in what spirit, and by whom slaves were to be punished. Both clearly preferred to inspire emulation, and they both believed their slaves capable of it. Poyen advised the planter to choose a few young, intelligent, active, obedient slaves susceptible to emulation to bring up and train to become overseers. When the black overseers reported the day's activities and pleased the master, Guisson urged him never, quote, to neglect to say so. Beyond that, the slaves will be greatly flattered. Nothing is more capable of inspiring them with emulation and maintaining it, close quote. And, of course, the discourse of emulation is everywhere in the 18th century. I mean, it's in political economy everywhere. Indeed, one suspects that Guisson and Poyen would have been horrified by the advice of an earlier planter's manual to recruit an overseer whose wickedness matched the wickedness that he ascribed to his slaves. Guisson and Poyen encouraged marriage and the creation of independent households. Both advocated the special care of pregnant women, new mothers, and their very young children. Poyen paired nursing mothers to work in the garden where they would alternate tending the plants and the children. Quote, in this manner, the children do not suffer. The mothers do only half of the work executed by the other slaves, but one can be confident that they will accomplish it. Close quote. Slave children were as much blank slates as any others. Thus, Poyen rewarded the woman who instilled the kind of obedience in her young charges that made them good subjects, his word. Guisson similarly entrusted the woman who tended young children with scrupulously monitoring their health and nourishment, as well as instructing them in the rudiments of religion, which instilled, quote, a perfect obedience and a great respect for the master, close quote. Certainly all these measures, especially the pronatalism that Guisson and Poyen advised, ultimately served the master's material interests. But both authors frequently reiterated that humanité was not in service to interest. Both that the two were equally necessary and that they harmonized. In a sort of peroration, Poyen insisted that his precepts served even the slaveholder's emotional needs. Quote, what planter is sufficiently his own enemy not to adopt the counsels of beneficence that I give here? Will it be said that I induce them to incur expenses that will absorb their profits? Will it be said that without all these efforts, as painstaking as they are expensive, his labor force will support and reproduce itself? I guarantee that these expenses will be profitable to whoever makes them well beyond what he spends. Next, I will add that it must be very different for a man of sentiment to see his work, to see his workforce happy and well maintained, or to see it sorrowful and decrepit, to hear himself blessed by grateful slaves, or to listen to them complaining and lamenting their fate, close quote. In a passage nearly as apologetically complex, Guisson urged the master to participate in his slave celebrations, albeit in a limited way and one that never became too familiar. Quote, a master will not disdain to pass a few moments with them to take part in their amusements. His generosity will increase their pleasure, and he himself will experience it inasmuch as he is sensible. There are circumstances that appear to bring together men the most divided by their respective situations, and perhaps many more than we commonly believe. The lines so striking of separation between conditions and estates are always placed too far apart. Nature ceaseless works to reunite them, even confound them. A master will not see without being moved, his own slaves penetrated by pleasure and joy, to the point of forgetting their chains and thinking themselves truly happy, close quote. Ultimately, Poyen and Guisson acknowledged their slaves as human beings whom circumstances had delivered into their care. They did not inquire more deeply into whether those circumstances in fact justified their owning human beings. They accepted the world as they found it, but took quite seriously what they considered an obligation to ensure whatever happiness, that wonderful 18th century discovery, inhered in the situation of slavery, and they believed that in the happiness of their slaves conduced to their own. At the end of the day, such expectations cannot help but strike us as adding insult to injury, even grotesque, burdening the slave even more outrageously by expecting him or her to be happy in servitude. Yet as perverse as it inevitably appears to us, this colonial application of sentiment permitted the slaveholder to flatter himself that being a good master also made him a good man. It did more than justify the power he wielded. It made it potentially redemptive and transformative for him and his slaves. Thanks for your attention.